Hello and welcome to the podcast, What We Teach Our Children. I'm Kim Clyden. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent and empowered children? And they say it takes a village, or what we might call today a community. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded though by people who can support us, your family, friends and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Children are our future, and the very existence of the human race depends on what we teach them. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. This podcast is about everyone who plays a role in that story at every level of society. What did you dream of becoming when you were a child? An astronaut, artist, or maybe even a chef? Perhaps you wanted to be on television or the silver screen like I did. Often parents have other ideas for a child's future. They may see a distinct trait of success in a career or expect a child to follow them into the family business. From personal experience, a dream left unfulfilled can leave its own scars and a void that is never filled. A few weeks ago, I met a young woman whose childhood dream is now her reality. Mackenzie Jordan Enkelmeyer, or Macca as she's known, is the collection supervisor at the Australian Age of Dinosaurs Museum of Natural History. She's only 23 years of age. Raised in a rural area west of Ipswich, Queensland, Macca has always been enchanted by nature. It was 2022 when a lifetime offer of an internship in Winton changed the course of her life. When I sat down to speak with Mackenzie, I asked her how she became so deeply connected to Australia's dinosaurs. But nothing could have prepared me for her story.
I've loved dinosaurs my whole life. I've loved rocks, particularly, my whole life. As part of that growing up, which I guess is a huge thing about this podcast as well, what ties in really well, is that my parents supported that. They were happy that I loved rocks and dinosaurs. And they were like, if that's what you love, then that's what you should do. Follow your heart. And they wanted to encourage that as well. So we came out here on a big family road trip in 2011. I was 9. And back then, this museum was a lot smaller. It was literally just that lab. And we did the whole Australian Dinosaur Trail. The only thing I truly remember from here is standing behind the chain watching a lady prep a fossil. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, I just could not believe that she got to touch a dinosaur bone. I was like, that's insane. Like, you get to touch them. Like, that has stayed with me my whole life. Being able to go around like Richmond and Huendon and see the fossils and rocks there. We went with my oldest sister, who is also a geologist. So her whole career is in rocks as well. And so having that around me, having a sister that was a geologist, parents that were so happy to just be like, yeah, like, do it. Like, oh, you like rocks? We'll give you rocks for your birthday. We'll buy you rock books. And a geologist for a sister who was like, oh, like, come out to this like mine open day where you get given free rocks. Like, I was in heaven.
I can imagine.
That's, yeah, and which is just so great. And then going through school, like, I never lost that love. Like, the second I found out what a paleontologist was, I knew I wanted to be a paleontologist. Up until grade 11, like, I wasn't a great student. I was like C's and B's. Grade 11 hit, I was doing subjects I cared about. I was doing ancient history, modern history, visual art, and chemistry. And I was doing really well. I was getting A's. Amazing. Getting A's in English, got invited to do English extension and thought, well, I love reading. I love books. So I will do this subject. But it meant I had to drop a subject. And out of my four electives, ancient history, modern history, visual art, and chemistry, chemistry was my worst one. And I'm really bad at maths. And so if I dropped chemistry, I didn't have to do like the hard maths at my school. I could drop down a maths level. And that maths was still like get me into uni, but I didn't have to do like the hard stuff because I was already really bad at it. I still am. And so that's the choice I made. And so I kept my histories, I kept my art, and then I did English extension. And so I did very well, but when it came to coming to uni, I couldn't go into a Bachelor of Science. And I sat down with my oldest sister, the geologist, and we were working out what I was going to do. And so I went into ancient history because that's the only thing I cared about at university was ancient history and geology. And I wasn't allowed into geology because I hadn't done science in grade 12. And so I did geology as electives. So as part of ancient history, you could go overseas to Greece to go on archaeological excavation.
No, that's my dream.
Yeah, I was like, this is it for me. Because like a huge part of being in ancient history as well is archaeology. I was looking at provenance, which is like finding the original origin of things in like pottery. And so that was how I was constantly like, I was still in geology. I was still looking at rocks, but I was doing it in this like archaeological context, which is great. I had a lot of fun. So I was going to go to Greece and do this trip, but COVID meant that that wouldn't happen. And I literally was just thinking, I had one semester left to go. And I was like, I need to do something. Otherwise, I'm going to be one of those graduates that doesn't have a job. And I was like, I'm going to go to the Australian Age of Dinosaurs. I wonder if they do internships. And I'm going to do the collection stuff because back when I was 15, I did work experience at the Queensland Museum in their geosciences collection with their collection manager, Kristen Spring, who is an amazing woman. She is terrific, taught me almost everything I know about collection management, just took me under her wing. Still there, she's incredible. Knew at that moment that I wanted to go into collections. So I was like, paleontologist, collections. Then was told that to be a paleontologist, I had to do biology. And I was like, no, guess I can't be a paleontologist then, but I can still look at rocks. But I always loved museums and I always loved collections.
Yes.
And so I was like, I'll come out to Australian Age of Dinosaurs, do an internship. I'll do my 2 weeks and then I'll get over to Greece and I'll do my archaeology and ancient history there. And maybe I'll go into a museum over there and do collections.
And it's 2024 and you're still here in winter.
Yeah. So I came out for my 2 weeks. After a week, I didn't want to leave. And it was because of the environment here. It was because of the people that I met. And I was around dinosaurs again. And I was around rocks again. And one night I was speaking with my oldest sister, the geologist, again. And I was almost in tears. I don't know if she knew that. Because I loved rocks and I loved dinosaurs. But I had just like done most of a degree in ancient history. Like, what was I gonna do? And she was like, you sound like you just wanna be a geologist, Mackenzie. She's like, you've always loved this. Like, why are you trying to force yourself into something else? And I was like, that's a really good point, Danique. And then, so I was here for another week and I made it really clear that I wanted to come back. And then there was flooding back home. So I was stuck here for another half a week and just kept working, which was great. I helped with the collection audit in there. I helped build an exhibit in that lab, like just incredible, amazing stuff. The collections manager at the time, Tricky, knew that I wanted to come back. And I was like, right, I've got one semester left of my degree. I just need to finish that. And then I'm free of my university. I'm free of my degree. I can come back here and just figure stuff out, like keep following my heart, keep following the things that are bringing me joy. And if you can do that while working, amazing. Went back to uni, just got through that last semester, constantly thinking about winter, constantly thinking about coming back, did more geology because I was like, well, I think I know where I'm going now. At the time as well, I was playing up doing an honours in ancient history. Like at this point, I was still like, I have to do honours in ancient history, otherwise my degree, like it's not worth it. But I didn't want to. Like it wasn't, I was like looking at these programs and I was like, I just don't want to. I just don't have any interest in doing honours in ancient history. Like I love ancient history. I still love ancient history. I've got a tattoo of a Greek artifact. Yeah.
Amazing.
Because it's so important to me. But I was like, I don't want to continue doing this. Like I've done this thing that's essentially like a borderline. I consider it like my hobby. And now I want to get into what my passion is, which is rocks and dinosaurs.
How fortuitous they found some out here.
I know, right? Incredible. Especially in Australia. But yeah, Tricky got me back. So she got me back for school holidays to help out at reception, driving shuttles, checking people in. And my first day back, they were like, would you like a tour guide job? And I was like, yes, I would.
Yes, I would.
So I spent 3 weeks driving shuttles, checking people in at reception, knew that I was going to come back to be a tour guide. So that was in like June, July. Went back home for 2 weeks, graduated from uni, packed all my stuff with the intention of moving out here. I didn't have a permanent contract yet. I had a 3-month tour guiding contract for August, September, and October. Packed up everything, moved out here, tour guiding. And then at the time, the lab coordinator was leaving. She was going overseas to do her PhD. and there was a position open up in there. So they gave me my permanent tour guiding contract in October. And then by January, I was the lab coordinator here at the museum.
That's an amazing trajectory.
It is.
It really is. What did you learn being a tour guide, though, that's helped you with the collection?
Well, so that's the thing, is that I was really lucky because when I did my internship, I helped the collection manager. Like for 2.5 weeks, I was just doing a collection audit with the collection manager. I learnt the entire collection, put away most of that collection and labelled it, helped photograph it, moved it around however many times, reorganized it, helped build an exhibit that included a lot of the material from that collection. And then when I was back as a tour guide specifically, she was actually coming, so she was about to leave as well. And so she was finalizing a lot of the stuff that we'd been doing earlier in the year. And so as part of being a tour guide, I was able to help with that and finish off this project that we'd started. I should say this was in about that October-September period. Finish the stuff that we'd been doing in February. And I just helped her with that. And because I already had all of this knowledge from my internship at Queensland, not my internship, sorry, my work experience with the Queensland Museum, she didn't have to teach me anything because I already knew all of the sort of the side of collections management that people don't think about. The materials you use, how to label something, being mindful that you're not just protecting the specimen for the next 5 years. You want it to stay stable for the next 70 years, and you want someone who knows nothing about it to be able to walk up to it and figure out everything about it. And then when I was the lab coordinator, that role was about the preppers. So prepping this material, making sure that we're prepping it in a way that, you know, is maintaining the integrity of the specimen. So we got a curator then as well, and we had to do this big data migration. We, at the time, were using an Excel spreadsheet for our collection, which is crazy. And we needed to transfer that to an actual collection management system. And so as part of my job as a lab coordinator, I was doing that. I was digitally going through our collection, making sure everything lined up, finding out all the information about every single one of these specimens, putting it in all these fields so that we could transfer that. So not only did I have this physical experience with the collection, I had to then go through every single registered specimen. We have 4,600 registered specimens.
Wow.
That's a crazy number to know everything about, not just the specimen and say like when it was found, but who found it, how long it took to dig it out of the ground, how long it was prepared for, the exact location of its dig site, what the specimen is, all of its taxonomic information. So much information just in my brain. And then, yes, some things happened earlier this year, and they were like, well, we need someone to actually, whose job is looking after that collection? Macca, like, do you wanna, you're like, you're the only person here that actually knows the collection to that level of detail.
So what role does passion from an early childhood dream play in your current position and your ability to recall and memorize all of this collection detail?
Everything. When you are passionate about something, it's easy to remember stuff. And for me, it's like the contrast between like my love of rocks and my love of dinosaurs with something like maths. I'm terrible at maths. Like I can count, I can do really basic arithmetic, but like I don't remember anything about like the Pythagoras stuff, like triangles. Like I remember like some of the stuff because it was ingrained, but I don't remember how to do it. I have no interest in it. You ask me about a rock that I saw when I was 9 years old, I remember all of it. I remember where so much stuff is in that collection because it means something to me. Mm-hmm. And when something means something to you and it's important to you because you just have this gravitational pull towards it because you love it, it's not difficult to remember anything. You just do it. It's just like breathing. And that's what makes it so easy.
A lot of people who haven't been out here, and I'm one of those people until recently, I saw the stories about the farmer who found the fossil and everything that happened after that, but I didn't know the degree of the dig sites out here. I mean, how significant is this collection and future dig sites that you've already got pegged?
Oh, incredibly. Globally, it is so important because for years and years and years, and I guess where this is really a fun part of my job, is that there were no dinosaurs in Australia. For a long time, that's what everyone believed because they hadn't found them. Because
we had megafauna.
Yeah, we had megafauna, which is a lot younger. But Australia was just seen as this like void from the period that the dinosaurs were alive because they didn't know how to dig for them. And so what makes this collection so important is that we are looking at really detailed information about Eastern Gondwana, this whole part of the world. And, you know, you think about everything, I guess the main stuff that people think about dinosaurs, the stuff that's often put through like popular media for kids as well, that's all stuff from the Northern Hemisphere. It's all stuff from USA, from Canada, a lot of stuff from China as well, and Mongolia, because they have incredible specimens over there in England and things like that as well, Germany even. Not a lot of it's stuff from Australia or the Southern Hemisphere because they've had the last 200 years to study this stuff. We're hitting about 20 years. And so if you think about how far that stuff has come in 200 years, and we're at 20 years, the information we can learn from this stuff, and pretty much, you know, every site we go to, there's something new. There's a species that hasn't been found before. There's an animal that's preserved. And so having all of that information and having people coming through who are interested in studying that and being a part of that process is a huge thing.
Why is it so important to understand the history of this continent?
If you understand where you've come from, you can start to understand where you're going. And I think there's also a huge thing in paleontology is you don't get a lot of funding in paleontology, to be quite frank. You're not out there saving lives. It's a labor of love. And you get to almost erect this image and this understanding of a past place. And you do that through hard work, hard yakka, and time and patience. You understand what used to be here. You understand why the things that are here now are here, and you can care for them and you appreciate them, and it connects you to the world. The fact that I have dug up impressions of conifer leaves and ginkgo leaves, which are still things we have around today, but the fact that my job is not only discovering, but assisting with the preparation and caring for the backbone of an animal that lived 95 million years ago. Like, that animal, maybe it lived 70 years, maybe it lived less, but there's something really precious about that. And being able to do that is very, very special. And it means that when we think about, like, at least when I think about stuff today, like, a huge area that I work on actually is lungfish. So I should say in there, I've also started my master's in paleontology.
Ooh.
So it's good. Yay. Time. Yeah, so I'm a master's candidate now. So I work full-time and do my master's part-time. And something that I look at is lungfish. So lungfish are still around today in Southeast Queensland in the rivers. They are critically endangered. There are some species in South America, Africa as well. That animal, the way that it looks, its basic body plan has been around for 400 million years. Like, it gives you so much more respect for what is around you and how
long it's been here before us.
Yeah, and how small human lives are. And it's very grounding, it's very humbling, but I think it also makes the world bigger and more exciting because you're like, look at all this stuff. Look at all these things that aren't around anymore that we can find. Like, that's special. At least that's special to me. And I think that's why people like dinosaurs, is it really gets your imagination going of a time that, while in a lot of ways it would have been really recognizable to us, very, very different at the same time.
Given that the lungfish is still around and represented, and many other species from megafauna and even the crocodiles have similar iterations.
Yeah.
The rest of those dinosaurs have gone by the wayside, and many other species, and we continue to lose species at a rapid rate through our country.
Yeah.
What hope do you hold even for the human race looking forward if we continue down the trajectory we've been going?
We can see what happens in the fossil record to animals, that they've gone through these big environmental changes. Now, sometimes those environmental changes are caused by, you know, an asteroid hitting the Earth. That'll always do it. Maybe there's a bit more tectonic movement and volcanoes are going up, but something that's really consistent in extinction events is climate change. And I don't mean climate change in the way that we understand. I mean, like, the climate has changed. Something is different and animals aren't prepared for that. And especially at the rate that we're going, animals cannot adapt to survive that quickly. That's just how it is. Humans, in the grand scheme of things, we haven't been around that long. When you're looking at any species, right, only for humans, only one species exists across the Earth. And statistically, that's really bad numbers. Even think about something like crocodiles. People often think, oh, crocodiles have been around for millions and millions of years. They're doing great. the crocodiles, or the crocodilians, I should say, that we have around today do not even begin to represent the species of crocodiles that existed before the asteroid hit. So you're looking at prior to about 65 million years ago. There were so many different kinds of crocodiles. They filled so many different ecological niches. They did so many different things. But then you've had this event that's caused the climate to change, and they have gone extinct, gone. And so the very few that we have around today is nothing. If something like that were to happen again, you've got a species, and even though humans on the outside, we all look a little bit different, on the inside we behave a bit differently, at the end of the day we've evolved in the same way, we've got generally the same body plan, we're adapted to the same thing. That climate changes, it's gonna go the same way for everyone. And sometimes people get very confused, because 95 million years ago, the world was wetter and warmer, and the temperatures were around the same as they sort of are today, and there weren't any ice caps. So there was no ice at Antarctica, because the dinosaurs used it as a land bridge between South America and Australia. So there are fossils on Antarctica, which is great. And people hear that and they go, oh, we're fine. We don't need the ice caps. And it's like, remember, these animals had millions of years to adapt to that climatic change. Yeah. It's happening very, very suddenly for us. And also, all the continents are in different places now. So Australia was a lot further south on the globe. So about where Tasmania is today, that's where Winton sort of used to sit. We were in the Antarctic Circle at some points. And so it was, we were in a objectively cooler place on the globe when the Earth was wetter and warmer, and you're experiencing similar temperatures to what we are today, where we're a lot higher on the globe, it should be warmer. And so when you sort of really break it down, things just don't add up. They don't work. And so losing these aspects of our climate that we've grown used to, and just thinking, oh, it was fine 95 million years ago, it'll be fine now. It's like, it was fine 95 million years ago because there was time to change. There was time to adapt. There was time to work it out. We don't have that time. It's a really complex topic as well from a geological perspective, because I know this is to do with mining. People get really up in arms about, especially mines in Australia. And what is really frustrating is that Australia has really good coal. We have really good quality coal, which is good because it means when you burn it, it's very efficient, very effective. If we were to lose that industry in Australia, excluding things like jobs and stuff, those companies would just go to somewhere else that doesn't have as good coal, and then suddenly you're digging up more, you're having to burn a lot more to get the same results. So it's actually worse for the climate. And so you end up with this weird, lesser of the two evils almost. Mm. But that sort of thing isn't often thought about or communicated very well, or not communicated or not listened to in circles that aren't interested about it. And so for me, from that geological, paleontological perspective, as well with my knowledge of ancient human civilizations and how they worked, I look at them and go, well, these guys didn't have to worry about that. They were barely doing anything to affect the climate like this.
One thing I always say, actually, and one thing I've heard experts say in a lot of different industries, is that we don't learn from the past. So what's your one hope for the future, given your research into the past here?
This is more my ancient history knowledge coming through when I think about ancient human civilizations, but something that's really valuable about studying ancient history is that you learn to look at something called a cultural framework. And so the way that we're raised, the way that we're brought up, that's how we see the world. A lot of the time when we think about, say, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, we think about those places through our own cultural framework, because that's what we've been taught to do. Fit it into what we know. They were a completely different culture, completely different life, different language. They didn't have the things that we have, and sometimes they invented the stuff that we have now. And so you get really good at distancing yourself from the past and looking at it objectively. You get to see a much broader image of what was happening, because you're not thinking about, oh, we have this now, so it would have done the same thing. You have to step outside of what you understand. And I think if people could do that more and look at our current cultural framework from a more objective standing point really helps. the world that we live in has a lot of depth and a lot of grey area. And so if you're constantly thinking about it almost in like a two-dimensional space of its eye, it's either this way or that way, really black and white, you forget about the grey and that depth. It's just, life becomes, it becomes very simple, but it means that you're making decisions with very limited information. Whereas if you can actually step back and objectively look at what's going on, and you can accept that there's more than just what's on the surface, and that there's other things going on, and then you're not always given all the information in one go. Sometimes you have to go and find it and understand that the information you receive isn't always showing you all of those perspectives. You have to learn to look for them. It means that you can make much better informed decisions. And so when you look back on the past and you're taught those skills through looking at the past, it's a lot easier to apply them to the present.
Australian Age of Dinosaurs Collection Supervisor Mackenzie Enkelmeyer, inspiring the next generation to pursue their dreams and perhaps even science. If you've enjoyed this story, I can recommend a trip to Outback Queensland. Maybe not during a November heat wave when it's 47 degrees like it was for me. Winter is much more comfortable, but you'll also find it popular with the tourists, so may not have as much space. I'll leave the choice with you. Are you enjoying this podcast series? Please let your family and friends know, or share it on your social channels. What We Teach Our Children is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Split Spaces, a nest for new ideas.